mystique around him. But of course, as we saw, as time went on, he didn't make life better for black people in America. That's why black people have Black Lives Matter now and are standing up against police killings, because he did not save them. You know, he did not, frankly, do anything to better their condition. You know, and the same thing, like having a African-American Secretary of Justice in charge of the Justice Department and stuff like that did not do anything to protect African-Americans from police brutality, from discrimination, from racism, from all the kind of hostile things which they face as an oppressed nation within American society. And it's the same thing we see in Canada right now. Having an Aboriginal person as the Justice Minister ultimately is not going to protect Aboriginal people from police brutality in this country. It's not going to protect them from discrimination. It's not going to protect them from institutionalized racism. It's not going to protect them against anything like that, because personalities do not make a difference with regard to those things. And these people are embedded in a system, a structure that is fundamentally racist and fundamentally imperialist. So therefore, they cannot be the ones who bring about change. It's the people who bring about change. It's the masses who bring about change. And ultimately, the system needs to be changed if justice is to be secured for those people who are marginalized in society, who are kept down, those oppressed nations. It's the only way it's going to come about. And that's what John Pilger talks about in this thing. So I really want Canadians to understand the same kind of things that it seems like Americans are coming to understand, that they cannot rely on savior figures. And ultimately, the problem is a systemic one. It's a systemic one. It's the system that is the problem. And simply by changing leaders, you're not going to change that. You're not going to bring about justice. And that really needs to be understood. So I'm going to play this. After that, I am going to play a real classic. It's Michael Parenti's talk on the political uses of religion. I always play this around this time of year because it's around Christmas time. And that'll be the show. So please enjoy. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Pilger.
Great, thank you. So good to be here. Thank you for the invitation to be here to speak, and especially to my friend Anthony Arnove. I'm delighted especially to be here on the 4th of July. Which is an appropriate day to talk about Empire, Obama, and America's Last Taboo. I'm sorry the title's a bit wordy, but I couldn't get it down to something as it should be. Now, 2 years ago, I spoke at Socialism in Chicago about an invisible government, which is a term used by Edward Bernays, one of the founders of modern propaganda. It was Bernays who, in the 1920s, invented public relations as a euphemism for propaganda. And it was Bernays, deploying the ideas of his uncle, Sigmund Freud, who campaigned on behalf of the tobacco industry for women to take up smoking as an act of feminist liberation, he calling cigarettes torches of freedom. At the same time, he was involved in the disinformation that was critical in overthrowing the Arbenz government in Guatemala. So you have the association there of cigarettes and regime change. The invisible government that Bernays had in mind brought together all media, PR, the press, broadcasting, advertising, and their power of branding and image making. In other words, disinformation. And I suppose I'd like to talk today about this invisible government's most recent achievement, the rise of Barack Obama, and the silencing of much of the left. But all of this has a history, of course, and I'd like to go back, take you back some 40 years to a sultry and, for me, very memorable day in Vietnam. I was a young war correspondent who had just arrived in a village in the central highlands called Thuy Long. My assignment was to write about a unit of U.S. Marines who had been sent to the village to win hearts and minds. "My orders," said the Marine sergeant, "are to sell the American way of liberty as stated in the Pacification Handbook. This is designed to win the hearts and minds of folks as stated on page 86. Now, page 86 was headed in capital letters, WHAM, winning hearts and minds. The Marine unit was a combined action company, which, explained the sergeant, meant, and I quote, "We attack these folks on Mondays and we win their hearts and minds on Tuesdays," unquote. He was joking, of course, but not quite. The sergeant, who didn't speak Vietnamese, had arrived in the village, stood up in a jeep, and said through a bullhorn, "Come on out, everybody. We got rice and candies and toothbrushes to give you." This was greeted by silence. "Now listen, either you gooks come on out or we're going to come right in there and get you." Now the people of Thuy Long finally came out and they stood in line to receive packets of Uncle Ben's Miracle Rice, Hershey bars, party balloons, and several thousand toothbrushes. Three portable battery-operated yellow flush lavatories were held back for the arrival of the colonel. And when the colonel arrived that evening, the district chief was summoned, and the yellow flush lavatories unveiled. The colonel cleared his throat and took out a handwritten speech. "Mr. District Chief, and all you nice people," said the colonel, "what these gifts represent is more than the sum of their parts. They carry the spirit of America." I promise you I'm quoting verbatim. "Ladies and gentlemen, there's no place on earth like America. It's the land where miracles happen. It's a guiding light for me and for you. In America, you see, we count ourselves as real lucky as having the greatest democracy the world has ever known, and we want you nice people to share in our good fortune. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, even John Winthrop's City Upon a Hill got a mention. All that was missing was the Star-Spangled Banner playing softly in the background." Of course, the villagers had no idea what the colonel was talking about. But when the Marines clapped, they clapped. And when the colonel waved, the children waved. And when he departed, the colonel shook the sergeant's hands and said, "We've got plenty of hearts and minds here. Carry on, sergeant." "Yes, sir." In Vietnam, I witnessed many scenes like that. I'd grown up in faraway Australia on a cinematic diet of John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Walt Disney, and Ronald Reagan. The American way of liberty they portrayed might well have been lifted from the WHAM handbook. I'd learned that the United States had won World War II on its own, and now led the free world as the chosen society. It was only later, when I read Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, A Manual of the Invisible Government, that I began to understand the power of emotions attached to false ideas and bad histories on a grand scale. Now, historians call this exceptionalism. The notion that the United States has a divine right to bring what it calls liberty to the rest of humanity. Of course, this is a very old refrain. The French and British created and celebrated their own civilizing missions while imposing colonial regimes that denied basic civil liberties. However, the power of the American message was and remains different. Whereas the Europeans were proud imperialists, Americans are trained to deny their imperialism. As Mexico was conquered and the Marines sent to Nicaragua, American textbooks referred to an age of innocence. American motives were always well-meaning, moral, exceptional. As the colonel said, there was no ideology, they said, and that's still the case. Americanism is an ideology that is unique because its main feature is its denial that it is an ideology. It's both conservative and it's liberal, and it's right and it's left. And Barack Obama is its embodiment. Since Obama was elected, leading liberals have talked about America returning to its true status as, and I quote, a nation of moral ideals. Those are the words of Paul Krugman, the liberal columnist of the New York Times. In the San Francisco Chronicle, columnist Mark Morford wrote, and I quote, spiritually advanced people regard the new president as a light worker who can help usher in a new way of being on the planet, unquote. Tell that to an Afghan child whose family has been blown away by Obama's bombs, or a Pakistani child whose house has been visited by one of Obama's drones, or a Palestinian child surveying the carnage in Gaza caused by American smart weapons, which, disclosed Seymour Hersh, were resupplied to Israel for use in the slaughter, and I quote, only after the Obama team let it be known it would not object. The man who stayed silent on Gaza is the man who now condemns Iran. In a sense, Obama is the myth that is America's last taboo. His most consistent theme was never change, it was power. The United States, he said, and I quote, leads the world in battling immediate evils and promoting the ultimate good. We must lead by building a 21st century military to ensure the security of our people and advance the security of all people. And there is this remarkable statement, and I quote, at moments of great peril in the past century, our leaders ensured that America, by deed and by example, led and lifted the world, that we stood and fought for the freedom sought by billions of people beyond our borders, unquote. Words like these remind me of the colonel in the village in Vietnam as he spun much the same nonsense. Since 1945, by deed and by example, to use Obama's words, America has overthrown 50 governments, including democracies, and crushed some 30 liberation movements and bombed countless men, women, and children to death. I'm grateful to Bill Blum for his cataloguing of that. And yet here is the 45th president of the United States having stacked his government with warmongers and corporate fraudsters and polluters from the Bush and Clinton eras, promising not only more of the same, but a whole new war in Pakistan, justified by the murderous clichés of Hillary Clinton, clichés like high-value targets. Within 3 days of his inauguration, Obama was ordering the death of people in faraway countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And yet, the peace movement, it seems, is prepared to look the other way and believe that the cool Obama will restore, as Krugman wrote, the nation of moral ideals. Not long ago, I visited the American Museum of History in the celebrated Smithsonian Institute in Washington. One of the most popular exhibitions was called The Price of Freedom, Americans at War. It was holiday time, and lines of happy people, including many children, shuffled through a Santa's grotto of war and conquest, where messages about their nation's great mission were lit up. These included tributes to the, quote, and I quote, exceptional Americans who saved a million lives, unquote, in Vietnam, where they were, quote, determined to stop communist expansion, unquote. In Iraq, other brave Americans, quote, employed airstrikes of unprecedented precision, unquote. What was shocking was not so much the revisionism of two of the epic crimes of modern times, but the sheer scale of omission. Like all US presidents, Barack Bush and Obama have very much in common. The wars of both presidents and the wars of Clinton and Reagan, Carter and Ford, Nixon and Kennedy are justified by the enduring myth of exceptional America. A myth the late Harold Pinter described as, and I quote, a brilliant, witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. The clever young man who recently made it to the White House is a very fine hypnotist, partly because it is indeed extraordinary to see an African American at the pinnacle of power in the land of slavery. However, this is the 21st century, and race, together with gender and even class, can be very seductive tools of propaganda. For what is so often overlooked and what matters, I believe, above all, is the class one serves. George Bush's inner circle, from the State Department to the Supreme Court, was perhaps the most multiracial in presidential history. It was PC par excellence. Think Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. It was also the most reactionary. Obama's very presence in the White House appears to reaffirm the moral nation. He's a marketing dream. But like Calvin Klein or Benetton, he is a brand that promises something special, something exciting, almost risque, as if he might be radical, as if he might enact change. He makes people feel good. He's a postmodern man with no political baggage, and all that's fake. In his book, Dreams from My Father, Obama refers to the job he took after he graduated from Columbia in 1983. He describes his employer as, and I quote, a consulting house to multinational corporations, unquote. For some reason, he doesn't say who his employer was or what he did there. The employer was Business International Corporation, which has a long history of providing cover for the CIA with covert action and infiltrating unions and the left. I know this because it was especially active in my own country, Australia. Obama doesn't say what he did at Business International, and there may be absolutely nothing sinister, but it seems worthy of inquiry and debate as a clue to perhaps who the man is. During his brief period in the Senate, Obama voted to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He refused to support a bill for single-payer health care. He supported the death penalty. As a presidential candidate, he received more corporate backing than John McCain. He promised to close Guantanamo as a priority, but instead he's excused torture, reinstated military commissions, kept the Bush gulag intact, and opposed habeas corpus. Daniel Ellsberg, the great whistleblower, was right, I believe, when he said that under Bush a military coup had taken place in the United States, giving the Pentagon unprecedented powers. These powers have been reinforced by the presence of Robert Gates, a Bush family crony, and George W. Bush's powerful Secretary of Defense, and by all the Bush Pentagon officials and generals who have kept their jobs under Obama. In the middle of a recession, with millions of Americans losing their jobs and homes, Obama has increased the military budget. In Colombia, he is planning to spend $46 million on a new military base that will support a regime backed by death squads and further the tragic history of Washington's intervention in that region. In a pseudo event in Prague, Obama promised a world without nuclear weapons to a global audience mostly unaware that America is building new tactical nuclear weapons designed to blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional war. Like George Bush, he used the absurdity of Europe threatened by Iran to justify building a missile system aimed at Russia and China. In another pseudo-event at the Annapolis Naval Academy, decked with flags and uniforms, Obama lied that America had gone to Iraq to bring freedom to that country. He announced that the troops were coming home. This was another deception. The head of the army, General George Casey, says with some authority that America will be in Iraq for up to a decade. Other generals say 15 years. Chris Hedges, the very fine author of Empire of Illusion, puts it very well. President Obama, he wrote, does one thing and brand Obama gets you to believe another. This is the essence of successful advertising. You buy or do what the advertiser wants because of how they make you feel. Unquote. And so you are kept in a perpetual state of childishness. He calls this junk politics. But I think the real tragedy is that Obama, the brand, appears to have crippled or absorbed much of the anti-war movement, the peace movement. Out of 256 Democrats in Congress, 30, just 30, are willing to stand up against Obama's and Nancy Pelosi's war party. On June the 16th, they voted for $106 billion for more war. The out of Iraq caucus is out of action. Its members can't even come up with a form of words of why they are silent. On March the 21st, a demonstration at the Pentagon by the once mighty United for Peace and Justice drew only a few thousand. The outgoing president of UPJ, Leslie Kagan, says her people aren't turning up because, and I quote, it's enough for many of them that Obama has a plan to end the war and that things are moving in the right direction, unquote. And where is the mighty move on these days? Where is its campaign against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? And what exactly was said when Move On's executive director, Jason Rubin, met Barack Obama at the White House in February? Yes, a lot of good people mobilized for Obama. But what did they demand of him? Working to elect a Democratic presidential candidate may seem like activism, but it isn't. Activism doesn't give up. Activism doesn't fall silent. Activism doesn't rely on the opiate of hope. Woody Allen once said, I felt a lot better when I gave up hope. I like that. Real activism has little time for identity politics, which, like exceptionalism, can be fake. These are distractions that confuse and sucker good people, and not only in the United States, I can assure you. I write for the Italian socialist newspaper Il Manifesto, or rather I used to write for it. In February, I sent the editor an article which raised questions about Obama as a progressive force. The article was rejected. Why, I asked. For the moment, wrote the editor, we prefer to maintain a more positive approach to the novelty presented by Obama. We will take on specific issues, but we would not like to say that he will make no difference. Unquote. In other words, an American president drafted to promote the most rapacious system in history is ordained and depoliticized by important sections of the left. It's a remarkable situation. Remarkable because those on the so-called radical left have never been more aware, more conscious of the iniquities of power. The Green Movement, for example, has raised the consciousness of millions so that almost every child knows something about global warming. And yet, there seems to be a resistance within the Green Movement to the notion of power as a military force, a military project. And perhaps similar observations can also be made about sections of the feminist movement and the gay movement, and certainly the union movement. One of my favorite quotations is from Milan Kundera. "The struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." We should never forget that the primary goal of great power is to distract and limit our natural desire for social justice and equity and real democracy. Long ago, Edward Bernays's invisible government of propaganda elevated big business from its unpopular status as a kind of mafia to that of a patriotic driving force. The American way of life began as an advertising slogan. The modern image of Santa Claus was an invention of Coca-Cola. Today, we are presented with an extraordinary opportunity. Thanks to the crash of Wall Street and the revelation for many ordinary people that the free market has nothing to do with freedom. The opportunity within our grasp is to recognize that something is stirring in America that is unfamiliar, perhaps, to many of us on the left, but is related to a great popular movement that's growing all over the world. Look down at Latin America. Less than 20 years ago, there was the usual despair, the usual divisions of poverty and freedom, the usual thugs in uniforms running unspeakable regimes. Today, for the first time, perhaps in 500 years, there's a people's movement based on the revival of indigenous cultures and language, a genuine populism. The recent amazing achievements in Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, El Salvador, Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay represent a struggle for community and political rights that is truly historic, with implications for all of us. The successes in Latin America are expressed perversely in the recent overthrow of the government of Honduras, because the smaller the country, the greater is the threat of a good example that the disease of emancipation will spread. Indeed, right across the world, social movements and grassroots organizations have emerged to fight free market dogma. They've educated governments in the South that food for export is a problem rather than a solution to global poverty. They've politicized ordinary people to stand up for their rights, as in the Philippines and South Africa. Look at the remarkable boycott, disinvestment and sanctions campaign, BDS for short, aimed at Israel, that's sweeping the world. Israeli ships have been turned away from South Africa and Western Australia. A French company has been forced to abandon plans to build a railway connecting Jerusalem with illegal Israeli settlements. Israeli sporting bodies find themselves isolated. Universities in the United Kingdom have begun to sever ties with Israel. This is how apartheid South Africa was defeated. And this is how the great wind of the 1960s began to blow. And this is how every gain has been won. The end of slavery, universal suffrage, workers' rights, civil rights, environmental protection, the list goes on and on. And that brings us back here to the United States. As I believe something is stirring in this country. Are we aware that in the last eight months, millions of angry emails sent by ordinary Americans have flooded Washington? And I mean millions. People are outright outraged that their lives are attacked. They bear no resemblance to the passive mass presented by the media. Look at the polls. More than two-thirds of Americans say the government should care for those who cannot care for themselves. 64% would pay higher taxes to guarantee health care for everyone. 60%
are favorable towards unions. 70% want nuclear disarmament. 72% want the US completely out of Iraq, and so on and so on. But where is much of the left? Where is the social justice movement? Where is the peace movement? Where is the civil rights movement? Ordinary Americans for too long have been misrepresented by stereotypes that are contemptuous. James Madison referred to his compatriots in the public as ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. And this contempt is probably as strong today among the elite as it was back then. That's why the progressive attitudes of the public are seldom reported in the media, because they're not ignorant, they're subversive, they're informed, and they're even anti-American. I once asked a friend, the great American war correspondent and humanitarian Martha Gellhorn, to explain the term anti-American to me. "I'll tell you what anti-American is," she said in her forceful way. "It's what governments and their vested interests call those who honor America by objecting to war and the theft of resources and believing in all of humanity. There are millions of these anti-Americans in the United States. They are ordinary people." They are ordinary people who belong to no elite and who judge their government in moral terms, though they would call it common decency. They are not vain. They are the people with a wakeful conscience, the best of American citizens, of America's citizens. Sure, they disappear from view now and then, but they are like seeds beneath the snow. I would say they are truly exceptional. Truly exceptional. I like that. My own guess is that a populism is growing once again in America, evoking a powerful force beneath the surface which has a proud history. From such authentic grassroots Americanism came women's suffrage, the 8-hour day, graduated income tax, public ownership of railways and communications, the breaking of the power of corporate lobbyists, and much more. In other words, real democracy. The American populace were far from perfect, but they often spoke for ordinary people, and they were betrayed by leaders who urged them to compromise and merge with the Democratic Party. That was long ago, but how familiar it sounds. My guess is that something is coming again. The signs are there. Noam Chomsky is right when he says that mere sparks can ignite a popular movement that may seem dormant. No one predicted 1968. No one predicted the fall of apartheid, or the Berlin Wall, or the civil rights movement, or the great Latino rising of a few years ago. I suggest that we take Woody Allen's advice and give up on hope and listen instead to voices from below. What Obama and the bankers and the generals and the IMF and the CIA and CNN and BBC fear is ordinary people coming together and acting together. It's a fear as old as democracy, a fear that suddenly people convert their anger to action, as they've done so often throughout history. "At a time of universal deceit," wrote George Orwell, "telling the truth is a revolutionary act." Thank you.
He's going to be addressing us today on theocracy versus democracy, the political uses of religion. And I have to say, in all the things that I've read over the years, when I came to Michael Parenti's works, I finally really found somebody that I agreed with, and the same goes for Dr. O'Hare, on this particular subject. and not alone that we agreed with, but somebody who was willing to actually say it out loud, or put it right out in a book somewhere for somebody to see. And I think you'll find what he has to say very interesting. Michael Parenti.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for having me here today. A few years ago, I went on a yoga retreat in the Caribbean, a little island. It's an ashram where people practice yoga. I went because I like yoga. Unfortunately, the head of this yoga sect was there, the head Swami, a very religious man, and he gave sermons every morning, which the guests were required to attend. And every day he talked about love and the higher cosmic force of love. And every day he talked about how spiritual things were everything and material things are nothing. He was an Indian. You say spiritual things are everything, material things are nothing. And then one day his yacht got loose from the pier and it began to float away. And he started to scream and say, "Get my yacht, get my yacht." And he had a yacht and he had a seaplane. And this man of love, I noticed, was filled with hate. He yelled at people. This man of God was full of ego. He got up and talked about how no one is perfect, only I am perfect. He kicked out a couple of people from the place because they raised some questions, and he threatened to bring the police in. And it occurred to me that this Swami was the perfect theocrat, that what we had here was a theocracy. Using the power of the state to enforce your will and countenancing no alternative opinions and up to your ears in wealth. In a theocracy, there's no democracy. Now, religionists say that they're anti-materialist, against materialism. But that word materialism is a very funny one. It's subject to a number of misinterpretations. In fact, there are two real, quite different uses for the word. There's philosophical materialism, which argues, as you know, that ideas do not exist as independent forces, independent of material reality, as disembodied mystical forces. As the great materialist Karl Marx said, men sometimes get ideas in their head and they're so vivid that they then impute to these ideas an external existence of their own as some force out there. Now, the religionists, to be sure, are anti-materialist in that sense. That is, they believe in these spirits and they believe in these externalized imaginings. But there's a second use of the word materialism. And when we use it, we often use it, I think, instinctively, quite correctly. We associate it with consumerism, self-interest, power, possessiveness, what I would call acquisitive materialism. And now here, most religious organizations really are very dedicated to this kind of materialism. They acquire throughout the centuries, they have acquired, and in many different cultures, in many different countries, in many different eras, the one thing all these religions have had in common, almost all of them, is that they have acquired vast properties and wealth, and they have used political power. They've used the legitimated authority of the state, the legal use of organized force and violence, which is Max Weber's definition of the state. They've used political power to advance their own material interests, to win gain for themselves, to exploit people, and in fact to maybe often win advantages over competing religious sects, because there are often fights between each other for who's going to grab the goodies. And for centuries they've been involved in secular intrigues, in conflicts, in wars, in ways that have often violated their own religious precepts. Let me give you just one example from the thousands of examples from history that I could give you. Martin Luther. Now, we all know the Martin Luther who started the Reformation with his anti-materialist rebellion against Rome. But there's another lesser known Luther, the other materialist kind of Luther, the apologist for the German princes, the defender of the aristocratic class rule. The Martin Luther who in 1525, when the peasants were starving, when their land had been taken, when they couldn't even get a decent amount of firewood to heat themselves, when their children were going hungry, when the rents were crushing them, and they were desperate, and they rose up in rebellion in 1525, and they took over the cathedrals, and they took over the castles, and they formed committees, and they reorganized the use of the wealth, and they reorganized the use of the land for themselves, and they rose up with dignity. That Martin Luther got up, and this is what he said. He said this is a blasphemy. He cursed the rebellion for turning, quote, everything upside down like the worst disaster. By the way, his own prince, Frederick the Wise, says this. Let me quote him first. He said, in many ways, the poor folk have been wronged by the rulers. Take something when a prince admits that. And now God is visiting his wrath upon us. But not Luther. Luther knew which side God was on, and God is on the side of the aristocracy. And he said, I don't quote him, is everything upside down like the worst disaster? And Martin Luther repeatedly urged, quote, everyone who can to, quote, smite, slay, and stab the peasants, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. And, of course, he quoted numerous passages from the Bible to justify his call to butchery. And the German princes didn't need too much encouragement. They slaughtered 100,000 peasants. And historians agree that that's pretty much the estimate that could stand. So this Luther, the great spokesman for the one true God of love and the Prince of Peace, was up to his neck in homicidal bloodletting in a repressive class war on the side of those who have more than they know what to do with against those who want a fair shake. Now, sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes the religionists use the state to advance their interests. That's what we mean by the religious uses of politics. And sometimes the state uses religion to legitimate its own exploits, and that's the political uses of religion. So politicians use religion, and religionists use politicians. This is not to say that nothing's changed. Indeed, there have been remarkable historical developments over the centuries. There have been remarkable victories for our forces. There's been a rollback of theocratic power. I mean, compared today to the 10th century, let's say. The diminishment of religious wars in the West, and the secularization of social life, with the advent of science, and with such forces as industrialization, urbanization, and modern socialism. But these advances don't come, and history doesn't work in a neat historical succession. Just when we think it's going one way, much to our dismay, it starts going another way. But generally, the move has been in a positive direction. But remarkable residues of the past are still with us. When you think about it, it was just 30 years ago that there existed an age-old theocracy. I mean, a theocracy that was about 2,000 years old. The society was still organized that way, in Tibet. And when the People's Republic of China reclaimed its citizenry over Tibet and sent its troops in and its organizers and its social welfare people, all these people came in, the U.S. media were filled with stories about these beautiful monks who had to be carried to India, who are now deprived of their religion. They weren't deprived of their religion. You could practice Buddhism in China if you want. What they were deprived of was their enormous wealth. The thing that the media didn't tell us about was that in Tibet, those monks ruled that country. Those peasants lined up and gave their food, their livestock, everything else. They exploited that peasantry. Those monasteries were rich. It was a feudal theocracy that lived off the backs of these peasants, and those monks had a good thing going for them, and that class was blown away. What the media doesn't also tell you now is that the average peasant in China, for whatever else you want to think about or say about the People's Republic of China.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we are listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Political Uses of Religion. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The average peasant in Tibet today goes to school, he gets enough to eat, his kids get enough to eat, he's got a co-op, a communal farm, whatever it is to work on, he's got some place to go to, he gets medical attention when he needs it. And those things did not exist when God ruled in Tibet. We also could note how theocracy, I mean this thing about this erratic quality of religion sometimes, when one of the most murderous and repressive theocracies emerges today, in the last 8 or 9 years, in Iran, the right-wing faction of the Shiite movement won a victory in Iran. You know, when they blew up all those mullahs and those guys who came for a mass meeting, that was the sort of the mujahideen, the reformist group. They were all slaughtered in one blow. The mullahs who rule in Iran and live off the people and live very well and are carrying out this endless murderous war against Iraq with the assistance of our cowboy in the White House there. And also right here in America, as the previous speaker pointed out, there has been a real resurgence of this religious right. For generations, religionists have served corporate capitalism. They've preached obedience to the status quo. They've opposed workers trying to organize and form unions. They've opposed syndicalism, socialism. It was portrayed as the work of the devil. And in turn, capitalists, the big rich robber barons and the owners, were inclined to present themselves as the recipients of the deity's highly selective blessings. Let me quote one of them. John D. Rockefeller Sr., quote, "I believe the power to make money is a gift of God. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money, and still more money, and more money, and more money, and more money, and to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience." So from this we may conclude that God is a financier. And so too today, social and political leaders constantly call upon God. Every president of the United States feels compelled to do this, but no president more so than Ronald Reagan. And it's a little scary. You know, it's one thing for certain right-wing evangelicals to announce that the Bible prophesies an imminent apocalypse, that we are now in the third and final stage, the third and final millennium, that the Antichrist forces from the East, as portrayed by Gorbachev in Russia, will meet destruction, Israel will convert, and Christ will return triumphant to deliver death upon the non-believers and elevate the believers up to eternal life into heaven. It's one thing to hear that from Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. It's quite something else when the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, tells us, or is indicating that he embraces the same mythology, that we may be getting close to the apocalypse, the final judgment between East and West, and it's a matter of public record that he's entered into such conversations about this impending apocalypse with Jerry Falwell and other fundamentalists who themselves have talked about it, and his wonderful grasp of the Bible and how the president really knows all this stuff. Before the National Association of Evangelics in March 1983, President Reagan proclaimed, quote, "There is sin and evil in the world, and we are enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might. The Soviet Union is an evil empire," unquote. And the United States nuclear arm race against the Soviets is, quote, "a struggle between right and wrong, good and evil." So God, it seems, is a Cold War militarist who is preparing us for a final nuclear confrontation. A lot of this, of course, was said before the Soviets kept coming and putting everything on the table and saying, come on, let's negotiate and all that. And millions of people got out there and demonstrated and said, go to Geneva and all that sort of thing. He's been dragged kicking and screaming to Geneva, and so now he looks like he's interested. But he has managed to avoid any single arms agreement up to now, and he may very well avoid any arms agreement. Well, they say that the Russians are scared of Reagan, and I don't doubt it, because so are many Americans. It's one thing when the fundamentalist Reverend Bailey Smith, then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tells a right-wing political rally that God, quote, "does not hear the prayer of a Jew." God is an anti-Semite, it turns out. That is, after he converted. It's something else when the president of the United States announces that the United States is, quote, "a Christian nation." Now, this surely must come as news to a loyal citizenry, which includes over 6 million Jews, several million Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, and millions upon millions of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and non-sectarian deists, who together probably compose a majority of our people. It's something when Reagan gets up there at his State of the Union message and says, "This country and our Constitution could not have been formulated without divine guidance." So I sit there and I'm saying, so God is not only our father, he's our founding father. As a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear on this. The framers at Philadelphia left the deity very much out of it. And when Benjamin Franklin suggested that their daily sessions should open with a prayer asking for divine guidance, they voted it down. And Alexander Hamilton said, we don't need foreign aid. The Constitution is very clear that ours is not a Christian nation. Article 6 reads, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And by the way, that was a distinct and democratic advance for one who has a very critical view of the Constitution, who feels it wasn't a very democratically motivated Constitution. Let's say that was a democratic victory for the people. It was even ahead of many state constitutions, which in those days banned Jews, Catholics, and non-believers from holding public office. And of course, the most democratic victory came not with the founding fathers, but with the concession they had to make, they were forced to make because of those democratic forces, and that was the Bill of Rights. When Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, let's have a Bill of Rights, that was voted down almost unanimously. I think Massachusetts abstained. Later on, they realized their tactical error, and they realized that they wanted to get this thing ratified. If they're going to win some kind of popular support for it, they'd better give the people something besides what they gave themselves in the Commerce Clause and all those other goodies and bills and credits and all the other stuff for themselves. They had to give the people something, and they put through a Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. Yet, the Reagan Justice Department is taking a regressive road back toward theocracy. A, ruling that the government can spend taxpayer money to subsidize religious schools. B, supporting a move to amend the Constitution so as to allow teacher-led prayer sessions in public schools. And C, pressuring the religionist crusade against safe and legal abortions. Now, here again, we're witnessing not only the religionist's use of politics, but the politician's use of religion. Take that last issue of abortion. These guys don't care one way or another about abortion. As a matter of fact, they had the opposite position. A matter of fact, conservatives for years supported legal abortion because their view was that the poor had too many babies and was too many kids on welfare, so let's have abortions, get rid of those kids. That was their position for years. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he signed the most liberal abortion bill in the world. And his daughter had an abortion, didn't bother him at all. George Bush supported legal abortions. They've all changed now. They've all come over. And why they came over? Because they found political gold in that area. Because Richard Viguerie got up and said, hey, this is how we can split the Democratic Catholic vote. Hey, this is how we can win more of the Protestant fundamentalist vote. And Viguerie even said it. When Reagan appointed Sandra O'Connor, he said, is she soft on abortion? We cannot give up this issue. This issue helps us split the Democrats. I mean, it is the crassest case of political opportunism. Once more, as in Luther's day, using religion as an instrument of maintaining your power, religion as an instrument of class control. And Reaganism has brought forth not only the politically more conservative religious spokesmen, but also the theologically more reactionary ones. Those who evade all real social issues. You can watch these guys on television all day. You'd never know there was something called pollution, or acid rain, or poverty, or exploitation.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we are listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Political Uses of Religion. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Employment, or inflation, or unfair tax laws, ruinous tax laws. You never get a sense of that. You never get a sense that people are desperate, fighting, trying to stay ahead of themselves, wondering how they're going to get through their old age. You never get any of that. All you know is that you're to blame, you're weak, and all you got to do is open up your heart to Jesus, and it'll all be saved. It'll all be worked out. They have no attention to poverty, oppression, to militarism. What they do is focus on personal pieties, sectarian intolerance, and a kind of prudish, repressive moralism. In the face of all the things we have to struggle with today, they're targeting Playboy magazine. Their message is the same as it's been for centuries, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Don't organize and struggle for social justice and against the powers that be, against the powers that exploit you, against the powers that take the money out of your paycheck before you can even get it home. Don't fight against them. Just trust in God and God's love, and above all, keep those contributions coming in. And what a God it is they sell. We already know from reading the Bible that the Judeo-Christian God is vainglorious, sadistic, murderously partisan, vindictive. In fact, if you had a person like that, you wouldn't want to associate with him for 5 minutes, let alone worship him. You might recall that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, including all the unoffending and innocent children and infants in those cities, because he didn't like the lifestyle of certain of the citizens and what they were doing. He took great satisfaction when his Israelites acted like imperialists and massacred. You read the Book of Kings where he says, and the Israelites slew 20,000. When the first time I read that, I was astonished. I said, my God, and God was pleased. And the Israelites went out and they slew 35,000 and killed them all. And God was happy. I said, my God, what a God. Not my God. And today it hasn't changed all that much to some degree, this whimsical, murderous God. When Mother Teresa, just last year, when Mother Teresa's plane skid on the runway, killing five of her admirers who were waiting there to receive it and maiming a whole bunch of others, she got off and she said, this was the will of God. And I'm saying to myself, but this God is Caligula. This God is one of the... or some other homicidal mad despot. We also know that God is a terrorist and an extortionist. Listen to Oral Roberts, who says that God's going to zap me unless they come up with 8 million smackers by the end of March. By the way, Oral Roberts made that same plea last year. He said, unless I get it by the end of December 1986, God will take me. And he denied saying it until they produced the tape, the videotape with him saying it. He said, oh, did I say that? Well, I say so many things. The truth is, he says he frantically needs that $8 million for missionary scholarships. That's a lie, ladies and gentlemen. His financial empire is in serious fiduciary trouble. It's been in trouble for a number of years. And he is going to go under, and that's what he needs that money for. It's not God that's after him, it's the bankers. And what transpires in these money-grabbing forays is something right out of the Dark Age. In one TV interview I saw, Roberts was sitting there being interviewed, he and his wife were there, and he was explaining his whole appeal to this other guy who was talking to him. This is about 3 months ago. I saw this on TV, and he said, well, about $3 million come in, and then when the money stopped coming in, Satan appeared. And I'm sitting there saying, what does he mean, Satan appeared? You thought that's bad. Then his wife chimes in. She says, that's right. Satan appeared, and I said, Satan, you get on away here, and you leave my husband alone. You get out of here. And Satan, he just ran off like that. And I said, where am I? And the credulous audience actually applauded. And I said, what is this? Where am I? Is this candid camera? What is this? Am I a little Johnny Lollipop in Disneyland? Are they talking? I mean, the image of this plucky little woman standing there with, perhaps with her rolling pin and chasing off the Prince of Darkness. I mean, it just... this is something, I said, is this the 12th century? Then I thought, they couldn't get away with this in the 12th century. If some priest got up and started talking like that, probably the curia would call him up and say, what's this you're selling? Because they have a monopoly on those kind of contacts. On another occasion, I saw Jimmy Swaggart on TV, fulminating, and going and twitching his frenetic bulk across the stage back and forth. And he paused at one moment, he said, hold on, as if a celestial long-distance phone call suddenly came, said, God is calling me. And God is telling me something. And then he stopped, and then he told them what it was. I forget, I didn't write it down. But then I'm sitting there saying, I can't believe it. This guy actually now claims that he got this message, and they're sitting there believing this, I'd like to do, can I do an experiment here, please? Would you all just put your hands up like this? Just put your hands up there. Close your eyes, wave them a little bit. Do you feel it coming down in your hands? Well, I'm working a much harder room than Jimmy Swaggart did, But... doesn't work. I don't have it down yet. All right. Then there's, of course, Pat Robinson, who turned a Republican presidential nominee, who turned a hurricane away from his home state with God's direct intervention. And God, if he's anything, is a meteorologist. There's the Baptist minister, Everett Sullivan. Now, this guy ran in the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. Four candidates. He came in fourth. And a woman won. And worse, to make matters worse, the Democratic nomination, a woman run. So here was the Republican gubernatorial race, two women running against each other. So what did Sullivan says? He says, this was a curse, evidence of God's curse. Quotes from the Bible, the good book, right? The good book. Jeremiah plainly tells us that when, I'm quoting Sullivan, Jeremiah plainly tells us that when the people of a nation are willing to accept the leadership of a woman, it is a sure sign of God's curse. Unquote. Talk about a sore loser, huh? Well, we always knew God was a male supremacist, too. Now, the point I want to make here is less a theological one than a political one. It's that the crude religionism of the right It demonstrates not only the obviously anthropomorphic origin of the God image, but also the exploitative, opportunistic use of religion as an instrument of oppression, as an instrument of material acquisition, as an instrument of political power and political privilege. It is not merely that the God hucksters are silly and superstitious, rather they are keenly self-interested, manipulative, and politically powerful. Not only do the religionists preach pie in the sky by and by, but they live high off the hog here and now. While preaching otherworldliness to their followers, they're up to their ears in the crassest pursuits of wealth, power, class interests, and, if we can believe what's happening to Jimmy Baker, other crass pursuits. They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we are listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Political Uses of Religion. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves. However, as I say, although history moves, and I'll sort of wrap it up here, although history moves in fitful and often uncertain steps, the general thrust has really been forward. Important democratic victories